Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and yeah, thanks for having me here. I'm quite excited to be here. I've been in PI like 4 years ago, and I'm quite happy to be back and recognize a few faces in the audience as well. All right, so yeah, today I'm just gonna jump in. So I'm gonna talk about causality bounds in low energy effective field theories. So this is one of my last project that I've been doing in my PhD. So my PhD is slowly coming to an end. So as you say, yeah, I am under the supervision of Claudia Durham, who was one of my collaborators on this project, and also Andrew Tolley, who also comes here at PI on a regular basis. And Mariana Carrillo Gonzalez is a postdoc at Imperial too. All right. So I'm just gonna start with a very basic introduction to effective field theories, something you might have seen many times, but just nonetheless, I think it's important to have it. So as it's in the name, it's just an effective description. We're not claiming that the EFT will describe physical phenomena at all scales. It's actually quite the opposite. It describes physical phenomena very well below a given cutoff in the energy scale. So that's this cutoff. We'll call it lambda over there on the energy scale, and everything that is below the cutoff, we'll call it the infrared region, and everything that is above, we'll just call it the UV. So to write down an effective field theory, you ask yourself what kind of symmetry you want to respect, and once you've been given this symmetry, then you have to write down every single operator that respects that symmetry. So generically, you will have an infinite tower of higher order derivative operators that respect that symmetry. All these operators will come with a Wilson coefficient in front, and this coefficient generically will depend on the energy through kind of the ratio of the energy at which you're doing your experiment divided by lambda, which is the cutoff scale. So a given power n, which is kind of related to the dimension of your higher order operator. So it means that if you're well below the cutoff, then this coefficient is small, and especially if you take a higher order, then it's a small coefficient to a high power, it's extremely small. And then meaning that if you remain well below the cutoff in the infrared, then you have a very good control over your the expansion of your EFT, and the higher order corrections become extremely small, and so you can just truncate your theory without really losing any information. So this is why it's quite powerful, because you can describe effectively your phenomena at low energy with just a few operators in your expansion. Now, if you raise the energy and you come close to the cutoff, then this corrections, or that is would be corrections in the infrared, become larger and larger, closer to one. And if you go above the cutoff, then the higher order operators will just blow up, and your theory is not under control anymore. You cannot neglect these higher order operators. And now you have to change description. You have to find a UV completion. So, but this is beyond the scope of what we're doing. So what we're doing, we have this cutoff lambda, and we just say that in order for our theory to be trusted, then we can only look at energies that are below this cutoff. All right. So this is just a very broad introduction to effective field theory, once you've written down your effective field theory, given some symmetry principles, you will have some information encoded in there, but you don't have necessarily all your physical principles that are encoded in there. So you might want your theory to be unitary, for instance, and this is not necessarily encoded in, like the symmetry of your EFT does not necessarily tell you that your effective field theory will be unitary. But that we're not too concerned about, because usually you need to do something pretty bad in the infrared to violate unitarity, for instance, having non-Hermitian operators, things like that. So this is not too bad. But for instance, what about causality? So this is what we will be looking at. And so causality is not at all encoded in an effective field theory. So if you want your theory to be causal, then it's an extra constraint that you're putting by hand. And since it's a constraint on your theory, eventually it will cascade down to being a constraint on the space of parameters of your effective field theory. All right. Yes. All right. So as I said, the symmetry of your EFT is not enough to ensure that you will have causality. So you impose causality by hand. It will give you constraints on the effective field, on the coefficients of your EFT. All right. So I want to start with a method that is called positivity bounds that has been around for maybe 15 years now. There's been a lot of development, and it works very well. It's a method that uses causality to constrain these coefficients. And so this is not what we'll be doing, but this is, for us, a point of reference. And we will have another method that we will want to compare to this one to see if our method can be trusted. And then we will claim that our method has actually a wider range of applicability, and that we can go beyond this and apply it to theories that are beyond the reach of these positive. So how do they work? So the idea, it's based on a scattering program. So like you will compute some 2-2-2 scattering amplitudes, and then without entering too much into the details, you will engineer some functions of these scattering amplitudes such that they are bounded from below. Yes, sure.
Okay, maybe so when are you ignoring gravity for this?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So no. I mean, you could do everything also on curved background. So here.
So you could
have a. Here for this specific type, positivity bounds, they only work on backgrounds that are asymptotically flat. But you can perfectly couple your low energy effective field theory to GR or another
graviton,
but not necessarily the GR graviton. It could be to the massive graviton or your theory of gravity that you like. But for these bounds, it only works with an asymptotically flat background. So that's one of the limitations. All right. And so then they manage to engineer some functions of these scattering amplitudes, and by using this, the fact that they're bounded from below, then it gets you bounds on the Wilson coefficients, and then there's a whole program on extremizing these bounds. So. Slightly, let's enter a bit more in details, but still not too much. The idea is that when you compute your scattering amplitude, then generically you compute some integrals over the energy of the scattering, and this spans the whole spectrum of energy, meaning that it spans both the infrared and the UV. So then you can cut your integral into an infrared part and into a UV part, and you can compute exactly the infrared part to get a number, an analytical answer, because you know what your EFT looks like in the infrared regime. However, in the UV regime, you have no idea of the functional form of your UV completion. So you cannot get an analytical answer for that. Obviously, if you think that UV completion is string theory or whatever, then you could get it. But the idea here is just that we don't want to make any assumption about the UV. The only assumption that we want to make about the UV is that your theory has to be causal. And this method is pretty impressive, because by only putting this constraint on the fact that the UV part has to be causal too, without having any idea of the exact functional form of it, then you can use some pretty complicated theorems in the complex plane. So they use some complex integrals and they can actually bound this integral by using the fact that causality will eventually imply analyticity of your function, your scattering function on this complex plane, and then it's quite, yeah, it is very impressive, because here you have no idea of the UV completion. You just say it's causal, and you don't get a number, but you get a bound. You get a bound on this integral, you get a bound on the total integral, and in the end, it will propagate to constrain your infrared coefficient. So this is...
Yeah, my question here.
Yes, sure.
So if I remember correctly, bounds also use crossing symmetry.
Yes.
And I wonder if this crossing symmetry is actually derived from causality, well, from for amplitudes, more than four-point amplitudes. What's the status of it? And of course, symmetry. Is it a traditional assumption, or is it derived from interactive resultant?
I think it is more of an assumption. Yeah. So these first bounds were just using the simple SU crossing symmetry, and the more refined bounds that have been found over the last few years were using the full crossing symmetry between the three Mandelstam variables. But I'm not sure this comes directly from causality or unitarity or something. I think it's more of an assumption that this is what we observe. And
it has been proved. It has been proved by Protest and Watt in 72. They proved, like, from basic, it has been proven in the mass case. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That causality would imply.
No, it's not really causal. Just related to the fact that the Green function.
Oh, okay. So. Sure.
So it has been proven for the mass case. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is what you.
But is that at all energies? Because here I think they kind of assume that it keeps working for you for the UV completion.
Yeah, crossing just says that you can access one curve from the other, that you have a path
yeah.
in the complex plane, and this has been proven. Full plane is free of singular.
Yeah, that's right.
That's an assumption. Yeah, that's an assumption.
Yeah, so here it's just a little detail that I haven't introduced, but they have a kind of a small regulator. They need a small mass for the particles that they scatter in order to have like a small gap between the branch cuts in order to be able to relate both half of the complex plane. But this is more just a mathematical technicality. Right.
So, I guess I need a couple of clarifications. So first, is that the definition of causality? Is that there is no fault there? Is that...
But that's not definitely.
What is the definition of causality?
So causality implies analyticity, and this is proven on asymptotically flat background. But there's no such proof for.
What is the definition of causality? I guess that's.
Oh, I guess here in this context, it would be the vanishing of the Green function outside of the. Of the light corner.
That's your definition.
For them, it will not be exactly the same for us.
Okay.
Yeah.
UFT, that's the definition. That the commutative finishes outside the light.
Okay.
For us, it will not. It will be.
It will not be your definition.
No. So here, yeah, this is kind of the standard method that I want you to be aware of, and then we'll have something a bit different. Okay. So, as I say, it works very well, but it's slightly complicated because. You have to go to the UV, make some assumptions, use some theorems there, and then this will propagate back to the infrared, and then you get some constraints in the infrared. So one, it's a bit complicated on the map side, but also since it relies on the notion of scattering and the definition of an S matrix, then it also has limitations if you take an arbitrary curve background, because then you don't even really know how to define these objects. So that is one limitation of this. So for us now, the idea is, we had like this very naive idea is, what if we just never go to the UV? What if we just directly impose causality at the infrared? I mean, it seems easier. So that's what we try to do. And the tool that we'll be using is the time delay. And the criterion will be that we should not get any resolvable time delay. So now let me explain what I mean by this concept. So time delay, you can imagine it as you'll make a, so here I say that the delay of a scattered wave relative to a freely propagating wave. So you can imagine two waves coming from minus infinity. One is just freely propagating on, say, Minkowski. This talk will be on Minkowski, but then you can think about things that are more complicated. And the other is propagating within, it interacts with the operators of your EFT, and so hence the speed of propagation is modified, etc. It could be accelerated, it could be decelerated over different regions of spacetime. But at plus infinity, then you kind of draw a finish line and you see whether your scattered wave has arrived before or after the freely propagating wave. If it arrives before, we will call it a time advance. And if it arrives after, we will call it a time delay. And resolvable means that a low energy observer, meaning an observer that lies within the regime of validity of your EFT, so you don't allow for observers that have access to energies in the UV because you can't trust your theory there anymore. So you only allow for observers that lie within the infrared region to test your theory. And resolvable means that such an observer can actually measure an effect. And so for us, a violation of causality will be that not only you get a time advance, but also that it is actually measurable by a low energy observer, which is what we will call resolvable. So that is the definition, the very simple classical definition that we will use. So here I'm just drawing a little sketch for something very simplified. So they say here on Minkowski, if you don't have any higher order operators or higher order derivative operators, it doesn't change your speed, it's just one, but then it will become different if you add these higher order operators that will modify the dispersion relation. So then, the idea here is that I want to make a difference between these two concepts, that are causality and subliminality, and that are kind of a bit too often mixed up. Right. So if we have a different speed than just the speed of light, do we need to impose that it's subliminal at all time, all points in space-time, all frequency, etc., such that we have causality? Well, what I will claim is that this is too restrictive. So I will claim, it's not necessarily obvious, but our intuition would say, yeah, sure, subliminality will imply causality, and that we can show it very easily, but it's too restrictive. So causality does not imply necessarily subliminality in the sense that we have defined causality. So here, drawing a little sketch, we have the forward Minkowski light cone. There's a particle or wave more that propagates from zero towards infinity, and it has a speed that is, this is the blue trajectory, has a speed that is close to one, but sometimes it's superluminal, sometimes it's subluminal, so that's why I've drawn some local light cones, so that's quite important. So locally, it could be within the light cone, but it could also propagate outside of the light cone, depending on the effect of these operators in your EFT. Yes?
If I have a lot of EFT, don't I always have speed of light? I mean, don't I always have maximum limit speed?
If you have what, sorry?
So if I have a lot of EFT, can I have speed of operation faster than light?
Yeah, it's easy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's just a function of either the sign or the amplitude of your coefficients, and you can design some very easy thing where you just have one extra operator, and depending on its sign, it could change the speed to be slightly superluminal or slightly subluminal. The whole program will be to actually detect these cases and not allow them. Well, slightly more complicated. So as I said, we will not disregard any superluminality, but we will disregard any violation of causality, which is related, but it's not equivalent. So here, this will propagate in the future, sometimes superluminal, sometimes subluminal. And then at plus infinity, some low energy observer will measure the possible violation outside of the Minkowski light cone. We'll call that delta x. And now we will only say that there's violation of causality if, well, first, delta x is outside of the light cone. But second, if the observer can actually say that this delta x is outside of the light cone, meaning that this delta x is resolvable for a low energy observer. So how does that work? So your low energy observer will probe this distance with a wave probe. And so this wave has a given momentum, a given wavelength. And I guess this is, it's called resolvable as a way to connect with optics maybe. And so in optics, you can only see something if you have a wave, a wavelength that is smaller than the object that you want to probe. So here it's the same. If you want to probe this distance delta x, then the observer needs to use a wavelength that is a bit or kind of order delta x or smaller. All right, and so generically this will translate into a Lorentz invariant quantity k times delta x that needs to be about of order 1 or greater. So here I say Lorentz invariance. So here I'm working in a very specific case where you have like a homogeneous background or something. If you have a more complicated background, then this quantity will become more complicated. But in this very specific case, then you need to construct some kind of Lorentz invariant like that. And then you can compare it to an order one number. And so this will be our criterion for causality or violation of causality. OK. So now I'm just going to link it very quickly to the scattering program that is used in the positivity bounds. So generally, the time delay, so this is really the object that I will be interested in, is related to the quantum operator that differentiates with respect to the frequency. And in this way, you can relate the time delay to the phase shift. So the phase shift is just defined as kind of the eigenvalue of your in-state after scattering. This is not exactly what we'll be using, but it's a way to connect with what they're doing in the positivity bounds where they're using a scattering approach. And so I'm jumping a little bit ahead because we will be working in the spherical symmetric background where this is where we get the better constraints. And then it diagonalizes for all the multiples. And so you get a time delay for each multiple. And hence you get a causality constraint for each of the multiple. So you will get a large number of constraints that you will be able to glue together to start constraining efficiently your coefficients. Okay. So as I said, I will be working more in the spherically symmetric context. And this picture is very much analogous to the Minkowski light cone that I've drawn earlier, but now rather than letting time evolve, we actually just send a wave from minus infinity radius and then it goes to the infinite radius. So this is the wave that is entering towards the origin. The purple one, if you can see, would be just the wave that is freely propagating, no interaction, nothing. So just comes in and out, no interaction. Now, if you add higher order derivative operators, as I said, so if you have some operators in your EFT, it will change the speed of propagation. It will create lots of different effects that will generally. So now this is the red.
Sorry, you have like a star there or something, but it's sitting in the middle.
It could be any potential that you like. Yeah. So generically, we will couple our particle to an external current, and then your external current could be whatever you want. Yeah. Yes. So now if you think about the red part, the red wave as being the scattered wave, the one that has interacted with your operators, then, well, it could arrive before or it could arrive after. So if there's some time delay, if it arrives after, it's fine. There's no violation of causality. If it arrives before, then we don't necessarily conclude there's causality violation because it could be non-resolvable. So we only start worrying. We don't start worrying when it's negative. We start worrying when it's negative enough to be observed. And so here, really, the quantity that we're comparing the time delay to is the inverse frequency. So you could think that that you would want the natural scale you would want to compare your time delay would be inverse cutoff. So that would seem like a natural thing to do. But then it's not a Lorentz invariant quantity. So what is the actual quantity to compare to is the time delay should be greater than minus one over omega rather than minus one over lambda, where omega is the frequency of your wave. Okay. But so yes, sorry.
This minus one is a bit.
It's arbitrary.
So
it's order.
Your bounds will be loose bounds.
Sorry?
Your bounds will not be strict bounds.
Our bounds will be using this definition, but we don't trust them too much. We will say it's more like it's not a hard boundary, it's a bit more like a fuzzy boundary that you should be thinking about. So it's not.
Then the question is how fuzzy is this boundary, right? What is the error?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's more quantitative. At the end, we'll see how much of the space, the parameter space we exclude, and then we can't. If we get too close to this boundary, we can't really trust it. If we're well inside, we can trust it. If we're well outside, we can trust it, but we won't want to come too close to the boundary because the
question is to what is too close and what it means. Well, that's a question.
So I mean, this order one coefficient is not. I mean, it's arbitrary, but it's not order 10 or order 100. So at the end, we could draw some. We didn't, but you could draw some error bars if you want in your space of parameters. But we're not too concerned about that. It's a bit more like of a. For now, it's a bit more of a qualitative way of showing that we can exclude a large part of the parameter space. Yeah.
So something basic I can understand, I can put just a spherical mirror so that signals just bounce off of it and come out much faster. So what's wrong? I mean, that why does it bounce off?
So sorry, it would come out faster?
I just put a spherical mirror.
Yeah.
The thing instead of going all the way to the center, it just bounce off of the mirror.
Yeah.
So that's why they pass off.
So that is actually something that we took into account. I didn't want to put it here because I didn't want to go too much into the details. But we actually also take into account here another term that is purely classical and that would come from a hard boundary potential. Because if you have a hard boundary potential, then you can have some time advance that is purely classical and that does not signal any violation of causality as you just mentioned. So this will be added to this minus one.
You can get mirror from quantum effects. I mean, it doesn't have to be classical mirrors.
But would it still be like a hard? You could still.
Yeah, I guess this question of what is classical is a little bit confusing to me. But because, I mean, if you're just doing everything from S matrix point of view, then you don't have access to what's classical and what's quantum in the middle.
Yes, so we are not really using an S matrix program. So we will solve. So that's the whole thing. The positivity bounds is a scattering approach. For us, it's very classical. We will be solving the classical equation of motion, and we will approximate this solution by WKB formula, and then we will compare the asymptotics of this solution compared to the free propagating solution, and from there we can get the phase shift, and from there we can get the time delay.
Okay.
Okay, so, well, now I've told you about the method, but now we want to apply it to a theory and be able to show that it's actually constraining. So this is maybe a bit of a boring example, but we wanted to just try it on the simplest theory you could think of. And also it was motivated by the fact that this theory is very well understood and very well bounded in the positivity bound sector. So the whole idea really was to get results on the causality bound sector and see if we, not if we agree, because there's no reason that we should exactly agree with the positivity bounds, but see if we get results that are compatible in the way that they show similar regions in the space of parameters. So so here we just have a scalar field that enjoys shift symmetry up to some caveats that I'll come back to later. And we only write down operators that are up to quadratic order, because as I said, in the positivity bounds, they only look at 2 to 2 scatterings. So at tree level, they're not sensitive to operators that are quintic, sextic, et cetera, in the field. For us, it's not a problem. But again, since we want to compare, we stop at quadratic order in the field. And well, we need to truncate somewhere. So we go up to operators that are dimension 12. And this is also a choice that is dictated by positivity bounds, because this G8, G10, G12 is the first triplet that is naturally bounded by the positivity bounds and that is independent from the operators that will come later. And then we just couple it to an external carrot. Okay, so as I said, it's not exactly shift symmetric. There's a mass term, this breaks shift symmetry. You can just forget about it. For us, we're not in our causality bounds, we don't need this mass term. We'll just set it to zero. In positivity bounds, they needed it. As I said, it was just to have a sort of regulator in order to be able to have kind of an opening in the branch cuts so that they could relate both half planes in the complex plane. But which is technical, it's kind of a regulator. They take it M to be small at the end. It all works out for us. We don't need M, so we don't need to worry about this shift symmetry breaking. So here are some of the positivity bounds that I'm writing. So this has taken lots of years and effort to get them. We don't need to look at them too much into details because it's not very enlightening, but there are some linear bounds and there are some non-linear bounds that took more effort to get. And this one especially is kind of the last one. Just a second. So this one makes use of the full crossing symmetry between STU, the three Mendelstam variables, and before they were only using a simple SU crossing symmetry. And here there are some coefficients of all the ones that I haven't written down. But, yeah.
Why don't you have G6 here?
Because you could have cubic operators. I didn't write any cubic operators. And you could have also, you could have something with G6. But this is the most, after field redefinition, you can always field redefine away your cubic operators. And you can show that this is the most general. So if you stop at quartic operators, if you stop at dimension 12, there's only 3 linearly independent operators. So you could write way, way, way more.
Could I have 2 derivatives and 5-4? Like, I think this would be.
Oh, but we also want shift symmetry.
Yes,
I didn't understand that. But we also want shift symmetry. But yeah, if you were to write down naively this Lagrangian, you would have way more terms. But then you can prove after field redefinition, or the easiest way to prove it is at the level of the scattering amplitudes, that there's only 3 combinations of your coefficients that appear up to this
order. The mass. So you say the mass is...
We don't. They do. And then they just say it's actually well below the cutoff and we can ignore it.
But they, who is they?
Oh, for the positivity bounds.
In general.
For us, causality bounds don't need it. Not writing it. Yeah. So you could just think it as a small epsilon that you will eventually take to zero. So Now, as I said, we will be solving this equation of motion. And before going into the details, what we'll be doing is we will be using the WKB approximation to solve our equation of motion. And for that, we will perturb our wave around an arbitrary background. And for the WKB approximation to be well under control, we need a higher key of scales, meaning that we'll need our perturbation to oscillate much more quickly than the background. If we do that, we can show very, very schematically. Obviously, we do the computation in a much more formal way, but we can show very schematically that this product that we're interested in, this frequency times time delay, generically goes as a large number times an integral over 1 minus CS plus small corrections. And this integral, then what you integrate over, it depends on if you have a homogeneous background, if you have a spherical symmetric background. It depends on the symmetry of your background. But what you integrate over is just at leading order is 1 minus CS. So from here, you can see very clearly that, well, as we were expecting, if you have subliminality, then this is always positive, and the integral is positive, and then you always have a time delay. You can never have violation of causality. Now, if CS is sometimes greater than 1, it means that your integrand can oscillate between positive and negative values. But it doesn't mean necessarily that the overall integral is negative. So really what it means is that you are allowed to have small amount of superliminality as long as they are localized in spacetime, and it might not even lead to a time delay, a time advance, sorry. Or it might lead to a time advance, but that is small enough that it's not resolvable. So really, causality and subliminality are not equivalent. You're allowed to have small amounts of superliminality as long as they are localized in spacetime. Yes?
Just this formula, so you are integrating over all space?
This is extremely schematic, so...
I don't understand this formula very well. So what happens if I grow the distance larger than the background, you think this slope? How do I know that this approximation is valid across the whole?
So here you will be, for us, we are only comparing asymptotics. So we are always integrating from from either past infinity or infinity in the radius to plus infinity. So we're integrating over the full spacetime. So if you have spherical symmetry, really, you're just integrating over the whole radii, and if you have like homogeneous symmetry, then you're integrating over time goes from minus infinity to plus infinity.
And this integral is fine.
Yes. Not necessarily. It will depend on kind of the choice of background that you make or things like that. But for our purposes, for this theory, for the backgrounds that we will have, it'll be finite. Yeah. Again, this is very schematic, so we have something slightly more involved than that when you look at it. But. Okay, so a very simple recipe to derive these bounds is, as I said, so something very important that I haven't mentioned is that the background is not fixed by its equation of motion because it's coupled to an arbitrary current, and so the background is arbitrary. It's just a function of the currents that you couple it to. So really, you can choose the background as you want. And well, this first step is not strictly necessary. You don't have to commit to a given symmetry, but we do it because, or we commit to a specific symmetry in order to obviously simplify greatly all the equations of motion and get something that is more tractable. But you don't really necessarily need to do that if you'll be using some advanced numerics. But then, at some point, you will actually have to commit to a functional form for your background profile because in order to have a number for your integral, for your time delay, and your time delay is dependent on what background you choose. So, so this is, I would say, the weakness and the strength of this method is that the time delay will be dependent on the specific functional form of your background. So you make a very specific choice. You compute your equation of motion. You solve them with the WKB approximation. You get your time delay. And then you get a causality constraint that is specific on this background. OK, so now you have something, and it's specific on your background. But now, OK, you could just go back to point two and slightly deform your background, choose a slightly different one, and recompute the whole thing, recompute the time delay, reimpose this constraint, and get a new slightly different set of constraints on you. And you do that over and over again. So you scan a lot of different backgrounds. You have a constraint for each of your backgrounds. You have a constraint for each multiple L when we are working in the spherically symmetric case. So you have a very large number of constraints. And when you glue them all together, then they start actually drawing a very nice compact region in the space of parameters. And then you compare with the positivity bounds if they exist. So that's what we will do. And if they don't exist, then this is where it's actually interesting, because this method has a wider range of applicability than the positivity bound. So you could go further and go on to constrain theories that cannot be constrained by the positive.
Sorry, what do you mean by extremize the Kolmogorov bounds? What does that mean?
Oh, yes. So your constraint here, omega times delta t, will depend on a lot of things. It will depend on the frequency. It will depend on all the coefficients of your effective field theory, but it will also depend on the coefficients that you've chosen for your functional background, etc. And so by that I mean just trying to get the best constraint given.
The strongest constraint.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other thing is this is like linear perturbation theory. So
yes.
What about like higher order interactions? That matter.
So we haven't gone beyond the linear order yet, but that could be something to look into. So. Okay, here I'm going to go through this very quickly. We tried a homogeneous background first, but it's such a constraining symmetry that it actually doesn't give very interesting bounds. It does reproduce some of the very basic bounds. So it tells you, for instance, that G8, so the lower order coefficient, has to be positive, some things like that. But it doesn't go much beyond that. So it was actually much more interesting to go through the spherical symmetric case. So in the spherical symmetric case, I'm not going to bore you through that. We have a few scales that are at play, and we have some perturbations on top of that. And these perturbations, they don't need to be spherically symmetric, and we will expand them in partial waves. So we will have really a perturbation per partial wave, and hence we will have an equation of a linear equation of motion for each perturbation corresponding to each partial wave. Okay, here again, I don't want to go too much into the details, but you can write down, once you've identified all these scales, you can write down your EFT as a function of only a few variables that are dimensionless, and that you identify need to be small in order for your EFT to be well under control. So we have identified three parameters that depend on the different typical scales of your theory. So phi naught, for instance, is the amplitude of your background profile. R naught is more like the typical scale of variation of your background profile, etc. And so if you make this choice, then you can show that you will never get any higher order terms that you have neglected in the first place suddenly become important. This is what we will call the regime of validity of our EFT. And so at every step in the derivation of our bounds, we will make very, very sure that we always remain in the regime of validity of the EFT. And this is very important because you usually get the more the tighter bounds when you get dangerously close to the limit of applicability of your EFT. And so you don't want to trust that because at this point, your EFT breaks down. So you always want to, so you have a set of parameters that need to be small.
Can you say again what is R0? Sorry.
It's just the scale of variation of your background profile.
Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, this is kind of specific to the choice that we made to have a spherically symmetric background. But again, you could find something more general if you have a more general background. Okay.
Sorry, like how do I ask that? Like omega over lambda seems to me can be bigger than one as long as it's multiplied by epsilon 2 is more than one.
Yeah. So you are allowed to have omega slightly larger than lambda. So omega over lambda, that was something that we took a while to understand. So omega over lambda being smaller than one is too constraining and it's not needed. It's really just this this combination. Because you can have omega slightly larger than lambda and never excite your higher order operators as long as you remain, as long as you keep satisfying this inequality.
What's the criteria exactly for those statements? Like, is it that loops are small or something? Like, what are you like composing?
So basically, we will evaluate. We will take a generic operator with a generic number of field and a generic number of derivatives, and we will estimate its size. And so we will want that any of these operators will have to be smaller than the G8 term, the G10 term, and the G12 term for any number of fields, any number of derivatives. And you end up with this. Okay. All right, so maybe now that we have our perturbations, then we can write down the equation of motion. All right, generically, they're a bit complicated, but after a bit of work, you can write down something second order, and after a bit more work, you can get rid of the friction term by a field of definition, and you end up with a very simple looking equation of motion. This is the radial perturbation, second derivative. So you have something second derivative in the derivative with respect to the radius, and the whole physics is in this W term. And so from this W term, you can extract the velocity of your wave that will depend on the number of parameters and also the effective potential that is felt by this wave. And as we expect, the velocity goes as 1 plus corrections given by your EFT, and the effective potential goes as the normal effective potential you would have in a spherically symmetric background plus corrections given by your EFT. OK. So now that you solve this equation of motion using WKB, so your approximation to order n, the whole idea is that you approximate your solution as an exponential, and the approximation is in the phase of this exponential. You have a series here. This series here generically goes as this first term is just the square root of W, and then you have higher order terms that I'm not writing down, because they are very long and not super enlightening. So here, it's all under control. There's tables and tables and tables of these corrections. But the interesting thing is that generically, they go with a suppression that is set by this hierarchy of scales that I was talking about earlier. So this is why as long as we have a hierarchy of scales, then there's a good control over this kind of convergence, if I may say, it's not really true, but over the corrections in your WKB formula. Yeah.
So this background would be your R0 related to your R0.
Sorry?
This lambda background would be related to the R0 that you showed in the previous slide, or in that scale? In that, right?
Sorry, so the big R is defined to be your radius divided by R0.
No, I mean the lambda background. When you have a series in lambda over lambda background? Like
in, oh, here, sorry.
Yeah, is lambda background related to R0 is a different scale?
Yes, that's right. It's related to R0. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this...
Okay, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so this ratio is the inverse of this.
So this series is... In the assumptions you made before, this limit, it's controlled well.
It's an extra constraint.
So
now it's an extra constraint. We will want this term to be small on top of the regime of validity of the EFT.
Okay.
So it's an extra thing. So now at each step, we will want to respect the regime of validity of the EFT and the regime of validity of our WKB approximation. And so we will be very, very, very careful at every step to respect these things. Okay. At the end, as I said, you will have to commit to a given functional form for your background profile. Here we're choosing something very simple like that. It's just a polynomial that is modulated by a Gaussian. This choice is just so that, because I'm not very good at numerics, so that I can integrate that on Mathematica and get an easy answer. These coefficients are just of all the one in front, and this is what you will be scanning over. So we make this particular choice, and we will change these coefficients. And for each set of these coefficients, you will get a given constraint. And then when you glue them all together, then you will start seeing an interesting excluding space in your space of parameters. And as I said, you always have to be very careful to respect the constraints. Okay, so coming towards the end now, I want to show the actual results. So I've rewritten the Lagrangian because you've probably forgotten about it. So there was three different coefficients, the Wilson coefficients. Generically, you would need to visualize it in the 3D space, but also without loss of generality, you could just set GA to be either 0 or 1 by just reabsorbing it in the cutoff. So here on the left, it's the most general case when you have G8 is non-zero, and you have G12 as a function of G10. I'm going to start with the orange region. The orange region is the positivity bound, so this is this has been developed over many years and papers, a lot of effort, and it's well understood. So it's an excluding plot. So it really means that everything that is outside of the orange region leads to explicit violations of causality, hence is not allowed. It doesn't mean that everything that is in the orange region is causal, because paper after paper, they shrink this region by having more and more optimal extremization procedures. What it means really is that if you have a theory that is causal, it will lie somewhere in this orange region. What we have is the blue region. So the blue region is not as constraining. It is, as you can see, it's a bit wider. But yet it's still a compact region, which is a success. And it's kind of just an order one difference. And this, we think, is also a very good success, because this is just the first paper using this new approach. And it's doing not as well, but fairly close to a method that has been tested for now 15 years, maybe. And also, it relies on a specific choice of background that we made. It could be more general than that. And a specific choice of profile function that we made. It could also be much, much more general than that. So we have a lot of hope in the future for scanning a lot more choices of background profiles, or just be more clever understanding which are more constraining. And so we have a lot of hope for our bounds to be more competitive than the positivity bounds soon. On the right-hand side.
Can I ask back? We're out of time, so
Did I go over? Okay, yeah, I'll quickly finish. So on the right-hand side, if you take G8 equals 0, actually you enhance your shift symmetry to a Galilean symmetry. There's no orange bound, actually the positivity bounds have totally ruled out the Galilean, as there's a caveat, so it's not the Galilean as, for instance, the zero mode of the massive graviton, because you cannot write down this Galilean as the zero mode of the massive graviton as a uncoupled low energy EFT of its own. So it will always be somehow coupled to the graviton. So here, the Galilean as just a scalar field on its own is not allowed. For us, we have a very narrow region. So we haven't ruled it out yet, but it's so narrow that it's actually in pretty good agreement with someday soon ruling it out. Okay, so I'm going to go quickly about that. As I said, it's not as constraining yet, but it's very close, and it's also compact. And so this is not we're not sure that we would find something like that, and so we're quite happy with that. As I said, there's a lot of improvements that that could be made. This is why we're quite hopeful. And also, most interestingly, we can go beyond positivity bounds. As I said, positivity bounds use 2-to-2 scattering amplitudes, so they are insensitive to any higher order operators in the field, like quintic, sextic, etc. We have no problem doing that. We are now working, or I'm now working on extending this to massless vectors, then it will be massive vector, then we want to go and constrain the graviton, possibly the massive graviton. And then, as I said, also positivity bounds are restricted to backgrounds that are asymptotically flat. We don't have this restriction. And more interestingly as well, for cosmology, positivity bounds are only sensitive to derivative operators and not to potential. We are sensitive to potentials, and so we're thinking, we don't really know how to implement it yet, but we're thinking that this method could be used to constrain the potential of inflation, for instance, which would, we think it would be the first time that we could do that. Okay, yeah, sorry for rushing a bit through the end, and yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, we can take a few questions before we go for lunch.
All right. I already have a few other questions. So, very nice idea. So, I was wondering, like, the plot you show, you put bigger than minus one, right? The omega times. Yeah, so how does it change when you put, for example, minus two or minus three? Like, how?
Yeah, so we've tried with minus two and minus one half.
And how does it?
And, It is slightly sensitive. It's not, so if you change it by a factor two, it doesn't quite change the bounds by a factor two. It's less sensitive than that.
So it's always outside the positivity bound?
No. If you do minus two rather than minus one half, then you're excluding more, and then you actually cut through some positivity bounds. So that's where also we.
Because a company that in this 2-to-2 case, this causality is proven to be really, it was proven that causality implies full free of singularity complex points. So, in this sense, you have to call the causality in, when they call the deep bound, they call the full causality kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
In a strict way. So, so in this case, I don't know what it would bother you for, for the 2-to-2, but I guess for multi particle case, like the things you mentioned,
yeah.
I want this to be very interesting.
Yeah, so our idea is that. This is not, what I'm showing you here is not interesting because it's already bounded well by positivity bounds. It's more a proof of principle that it works, and it works pretty well. And now we can go to cases where you don't have positivity bounds. And then even if our bounds cannot be trusted exactly, even if it's slightly fuzzy, it still gives you something and where there was nothing before. Yeah.
Yeah, and you say it's compact, at some point it cuts off the...
It cuts off not due to an actual constraint, but due to the regime of validity of your EFT. So the value of G12 cannot be too large.
If it would be too large, then it could loops and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
So your assumption is you have the approximation,
mm-hmm.
and you also have this EFT.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just another question. So this positivity bound, does that depend on the choice of background?
No.
So
no.
What does it depend on?
It's so they have an infinite amount of functions of the scattering amplitude. And they can generate them. So they have a generator for this function. They can generate them by taking derivative with respect to S, T, and U, and things like that. And it really only depends on how well they can take this infinite amount of bounds and extremize them.
Yeah, but they're not imposing crossing symmetry.
So yeah.
They are imposing crossing symmetry when they impose these functionals, which is crossing symmetry, which is a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess I'm trying to understand how can people improve it? I mean, it's just one bound.
What about it again?
How can people improve the bound? Because you say it's changed over 15 years. So
it's crossing. So Kotlov is an elliptic in the column. Yeah. They also have crossing symmetry in between S and U channels. So, but they use the fixed scattering angle. But then you also have crossing the scattering angle. So this is not imposed directly by the Jewish, you have to impose additional things, and these are exactly these functionals. So that's where the improvement comes from. Yeah.
No further questions, then let's
Yeah, thank you.